Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Halloween in a COVID world stands to be one of the potentially scariest holidays so far this year, and it'll be upon us soon. So where do you stand on celebrating, trick-or-treating, or maybe you're just going to take a pass on Halloween 2020? We'll help you figure it all out with a mom and medical authority as we open up today's program. Then we're going to get some sobering news and maybe a little spark of hope as we touch base with the Connecticut Center for Economic Analysis. We'll get the latest lowdown on jobs and household income growth and how they are being impacted by the COVID pandemic. And we'll find out how legalized cannabis could go far toward propelling Connecticut out of the sorry economic state we find ourselves in right now. Then we're going to close with a visit from the Beardsley Zoo's lead educator on Monarch Watch, an important environmental partnership that's putting everyday folks like you to work, helping protect and sustain the world's endangered monarch butterfly population. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. With summer's heat fading and Connecticut residents warm and improve home air quality and filtration, homeowners can address these concerns now by taking advantage of heat pump technology and low-rate financing through the Energize CT Smart E-Loan. Offered through the Connecticut Green Bank, select local banks and credit unions and a network of contractors are providing this special limited-time Smart E-Loan offer with a 2.99% financing package for 5, 7, or 10-year term installations. This special offer was designed to support Connecticut's climate change plan, which aims to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 45% by the year 2030. Learn more about this special offer at ctgreenbank.com/smartheatpump. So, we're going to open up the program this morning talking about a holiday that's roughly about a month away as we broadcast this here on the last Sunday in September. I'm talking about Halloween, trick-or-treating, what's going to be happening with it back to school, at least somewhat figured out. Parents are now wondering, is it going to be safe to trick or treat in Connecticut this year? City officials in numerous municipalities have already begun discussing whether or not to ban Halloween, with some considering even fines if citizens are gathered in large costumed groups. Our new resource and friend to the award-winning For the People, Dr. Jeannie Kankary, is the chief medical officer of Physician One Urgent Care, and she's a mom. She's got concerns about the safety of trick-or-treating and other Halloween activities amid the pandemic, and she's here to talk a little bit about it for the next 10 or 12 minutes. So, Jeannie, thank you for joining us this morning. So how old are your little ones, or are they that little?
My kids are a little bit older. My youngest is 13, so she still wants to trick or treat. Sure. My older ones are in their teens, teens.
Yeah, still, Halloween is a super important holiday for kids in their teen years. It's it takes on a little bit more of a fun grown up kind of flavor once you get out of those adolescent years. So I imagine you are as eager to determine how things are going to go on October 31st as they are, especially since it's going to be a Saturday. There's going to be a blue moon or some sort of a second second monthly full moon that night. It will be the quintessential Halloween, made even more so in a twisted Stephen King-like way with the presence of a global pandemic. So I'm so glad we've got you on the line now with enough lead time to be able to give parents, municipal leaders, and anyone who cares to tune in a little bit of perspective. So first and foremost, let's talk a little bit about what the risks are that you see right now associated with door-to-door trick-or-treating. And I That's a really challenging question because the COVID transmission situation of the last Sunday in September could be drastically different than the COVID transmission situation on the last weekend of October, right?
Yeah, you're right. You're right. All of this does, you know, I think the transmission rate and the number of positives and percentage, you know, is going to play into this, you know, during the time that we're talking about. So, you know,
well, we can only deal with what we know today. So what should parents be most concerned about when it comes to door-to-door trick-or-treating?
Well, so I think that it's key to understand, you know, what we know about COVID right now. So we can make some educated decisions about what the risks are. And what we know is that COVID is transmitted through close contact. So what does close contact mean? Our definition of close contact right now is more than 15 minutes within 6 feet. So you'd say, well, when I'm in, when I'm trick-or-treating, there's no way my kids are going to be as close to anybody as 6 feet for 15 minutes. It's for brief moments. So that's good news. And I think that, you know, can help us to make some decisions. But you also have to consider what else they're coming into contact with. So when you think about a host who's giving out the candy, is that host unwittingly infected with COVID, and now they're infecting their hands, which is touching the candy and handing it to the child? Or are the kids digging their hands into a bowl that's a community bowl that other people who might have had COVID have stuck their hands into too? Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, those are the types of things that I think about as a medical professional when I'm thinking about what are the risks of door-to-door trick-or-treating.
Yeah, and I have to say, I sorry to interrupt you, I was remiss in the introduction not reminding folks that you're not just a mom and a local physician, you're chief medical officer at Physician One Urgent Care, so you know, you've got quite a wealth of experience and education to back up what you're talking about today. Given the risks, first and foremost, I guess, what precautions are you at this point advising parents to take to mitigate that COVID spread?
So I think that the best things to do would be to think about alternatives to going door to door and expanding that circle that you don't really know. So, you know, what we've all been really cautious about is making sure that we know where our own contacts have been and who else they've been in contact with, and trying to understand what their risk level is and their associated risks. So when you're going door to door, you're really expanding that circle, or what we call the bubble. And so, you know, my recommendation would be to, you know, minimize that by controlling what the exposure is. So I'm not saying let's not celebrate Halloween, but maybe trick-or-treating isn't the way to do it this year in light of the COVID pandemic. So I think, you know, if we are doing maybe something like a Halloween celebration with a limited number of people, that it's done outside where we know the air exchange is perfect, mm-hmm. rather than being inside, maintaining social distancing, so more than 6 feet, and minimizing shared food or drinks. Mm-hmm. So how do you do that? Maybe there's somebody that's preparing small portions that get individually packaged and handed out, and these, you know, delivering candies that way as well.
Okay. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Please do.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, if people really, really are fixed on going trick-or-treating, maybe the best way to do it is going to places that you know, people that you know, and doing it with prepackaged goods rather than community type bowls, and wearing masks so that there's minimizing that risk of transmitting it through the air.
Well, talk more about the mask issue, because, you know, the running joke going back to when people started talking about Halloween, when candy went on the racks right after the 4th of July, people were talking about, well, Halloween, you're always wearing masks. There's not going to be a problem. But for those who are the many Connecticut residents that are helping to keep us in as good a place as we can be because of their adherence to the masks mandate, what are some ways that you see the protective face masks integrating with the successfully and aesthetically with any kind of face coverings or masks or headpieces or anything that might be part of the costume?
You know, I think it's important to talk about, you know, what does it mean to be masked when we're talking about COVID transmission versus being masked for Halloween, right?
Yep.
It's not the same thing. So a mask that's protective from a infection control standpoint is one that creates a barrier between the breathed air or the exhaled or an inhaled air that the patient is coming, or the child, adult, whatever is coming in contact with. And so that means it's something that covers and filters both the air coming in and out through the nose and the mouth. So the types of coverings that we've, you know, kind of identified with COVID are those cloth coverings or those surgical masks. And that it's important to recognize that that's really important. So the Halloween type of mask has a hole at the mouth or a hole at the nose. It's not the same type of barrier. Does it provide any protection? It probably does, because it's still a barrier and you're not getting as much open air. So maybe there's a little bit of protection there, but why not integrate, you know, I mean, it would be funny, right? Let's put a surgical mask over our Halloween costume mask. Mm-hmm. And there you have it. You'll have your protection.
But would you say that also wearing a mask in such a way where we may not necessarily wear a Halloween mask? I mean, keeping the face mask or face covering, just like we would in a school or a work or neighborhood, you know, shopping environment, and then putting the Halloween mask decorative face piece over the protective mask. That in my mind, that seems to work. You're getting the benefit of the double layer barrier between the mouth and the outer mask, and then maybe even the enhanced protection of a secondary aesthetic or costume mask, right?
Yeah, that's a great idea. I think having that you know, mask underneath the decorative mask is a great idea, and probably even more protective than putting it on top, because you get you're closer to the mouth and the nose that way.
Very good. While we have you on the line, I did want to change gears a little bit, and I thank you for all this important information as parents consider and neighborhoods and communities consider what's going to be happening on and around Halloween. You know, another thing we talk about at Halloween season is saying boo to the flu and making sure you get your flu vaccine. Let's talk really quick. We've got about 2 or 3 minutes left with you, Dr. Kincarry. Let's talk about the similarities and differences between symptoms of COVID-19 and the flu or common cold, which is also going to be visiting many more of us in the next few months.
Sure. So the many of the symptoms are very similar. So flu and COVID share fever, headache, body aches, sometimes GI symptoms, and the upper respiratory and lower respiratory symptoms like runny nose, congestion, sore throat, coughing, shortness of breath. So very much similar symptoms. And with respect to, I think you mentioned the flu shot, you know, it's a really important preventative measure to help prevent getting the flu, or at least minimizing the medical impact of getting the flu if you've had your vaccine.
Yeah, so I
really highly recommend getting the vaccine.
Yeah, I was going to say if everyone gets the flu vaccine, then it makes it a lot easier to identify and get testing and support to individuals who may be exhibiting flu-like symptoms post-flu vaccine, which would be, lean toward a more like greater likelihood that they may have contracted COVID, right?
That's true. Absolutely. So when we, evaluate a patient who's got symptoms and they've had the vaccine versus somebody who doesn't have the vaccine, we're almost eliminating the likelihood of flu as the contributing cause in the patient who's had the vaccine. It doesn't totally eliminate it, but it certainly helps to make the diagnosis, go down a pathway, and it will minimize the strain on the health system, which was so impacted back in March and April when we were first hit with the first wave of COVID. So as we're getting ready for flu season, it would be really great if we were able to eliminate this surge in medical need by making sure that people are getting their flu vaccine.
Well, we will continue to keep you and all the frontline medical and responders in our thoughts, Dr. Kinkari.
Thank you.
And we thank you for this educated bit of information as parents and communities think about what they're going to do with Halloween, with the added benefit of getting a little plug-in for the flu vaccine and why it's most critically important this year, maybe more than ever. Dr. Kinkari is a local physician, mom, chief medical officer at Physician One Urgent Care, and we appreciate you taking the time to talk with us this morning. Have a great Halloween, however it is you end up celebrating. Doctor, take care. Well, the voice on the other end of the line this morning for this segment is one that I have missed on the award-winning For the People. Fred Carstensen was a staple resource here on our program for so many years, and we're so excited after several years of missing him that he is back on the air with us. He is the director of the Connecticut Center for Economic Analysis, and he's a professor at the UConn School of Business. And today we're going to really be concentrating on two very different aspects of employment and economics here in Connecticut. Fred has been great in forwarding me breaking economic information. And in the past 48 hours, we've got some very, very disturbing news from the Federal Bureau of Economic Analysis, as well as the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So, Fred, we got a lot to talk about. Let's jump into these two back-to-back federal reports. And let's start it with the BLS, because you contacted me yesterday indicating sort of a disparity between what the federal government was reporting from the top down and what Connecticut is reporting from the bottom up. What's the story on that?
Well, the BLS, every Thursday morning at 8:30, releases a report on how many initial filings for unemployment have occurred across the nation as of a week ago. And it includes then a lot of additional information on total unemployment, how many people are actually receiving unemployment benefits right now. And it's really striking. You have to start, first of all, by understanding that the jobs report, the official jobs report, comes out once a month on the first Friday of each month, is designed to minimize the number of people that are considered unemployed. The last official jobs report said that the national unemployment was 8.4. Now, that's what's called U3. It's the third statistical measure. Mm-hmm. And it's designed in a way that will, as they say, minimize the number of people who are counted as unemployed. And this goes literally back 100 years. because politically folks have not wanted to admit how bad things are. There is an additional measure in that monthly report that is the U6. You can always go and look, and anybody out there who's listening can go and get the BLAS jobs report. And U6 is the broadest measure that they provide. And for August, the U6 was over 14%. So, and then if you look at how it's been going, the official number, the 8.4, has been going down faster than the U6, which tells you that things are probably not nearly as good nationally. Now, this morning, the report actually has the number that should be reported in October for September, because the official jobs report, that monthly report, is always based on the week that includes the 12th of the month. Well, this morning's report actually includes the week of September 12th. And it says the national unemployment rate is 8.4%. In other words, it hasn't changed anything from what it was. Moreover, on initial filings, it says there's still about 860,000 new filings. So that's about where it was last week. This is a very narrow measure because this does not include gig workers and independent contractors. So that report says there's no improvement. A week ago, Connecticut was actually also on state level, had the high, was sixth highest unemployment in the nation, 11.7%. Now, our State Department of Labor was reporting it was 8.1, but they're using a measure which, as I say, minimizes it. According to the official data, in fact, our unemployment rate was much higher. And this week, you know, it's very nice to see Connecticut fell off the list of the seven, eight worst states in the country. We're still probably are up pretty high. It's got a lot of small data in there, but it nationally, things don't look good. If you look at the bigger number, how many people in the country right now are receiving unemployment benefits? Now, that includes people who are covered by the normal unemployment benefits framework, which only covers people who are on payroll. It excludes a tremendous share of the economy. Under the Relief Act, we permitted gig workers and independent contractors who've lost employment also to file for benefits. Well, as of a week ago, which is the most current data we have, 26 plus million are receiving benefits. That itself, just that number, implies an unemployment rate of roughly 16%. So nationally and in the state of Connecticut, things are looking as if at best we're flatlining. We may actually have started to go backward. And October 1st, there will be literally tens of thousands of additional layoffs or possibly furloughs, because the airlines will no longer be under the federal restriction. They got, you know, billions of dollars to keep their people on. And that runs out on October 1st. They've already announced that they're going to be laying off thousands of people. There are lots of other industries. There was just a news report recently that a survey of businesses said that they will not be bringing back the workers that they have furloughed, and they may, in fact, be laying off more workers.
So this near, I was going to say, this near future occurrence is doubly concerning in relation to and as we speak, as we're recording this on September 24th, on Thursday around noontime, today there is you know, bad news from the Bureau of Economic Analysis
as well, because it specifically for Connecticut, because it released its estimates of household income for the second quarter, which is when we were in the pandemic. But we were also getting the $600 a week supplemental benefits, all of the other kind of interventions that did do a very good job of propping up the economy in the short run, but now have expired. And we haven't seen the full impact of that expiration. That's going to be coming down the pike in the next quarter in all likelihood. But yeah, because people can no longer pay their rent. We're already seeing a lot of evictions, more and more bankruptcies. In that report this morning from the Bureau of Economic Analysis, Connecticut is 49th. And I was talking to somebody earlier who called me about this, and I actually said, well, in a way, that's good news because we're not 50th, because we are 50th as a state economy over the last 10 years. Our economy actually shrank between 2008, when we hit the peak, and February of 2020. Our economy was still, in inflation-adjusted real terms, the gross state product was about 6% smaller than it had been in 2008. We actually shrank as a state economy until 2016. And then we began almost 10%. And then we began a very, very modest recovery. So we're only down about, but no other, there's only one other state that's below full recovery. And our neighboring states, and this is really critical because a lot of this stuff is regional. How is it that Massachusetts, Rhode Island, New York all fully recovered and got well past their previous peaks, both in employment and in output? And Connecticut sits there between three successful states, and we're like a black hole.
Well, what is what?
Who, very wrong.
Who has ventured a theory as to why that is?
Well, of course, it's Fred Carstensen, because that's my job. Well, first of all, let's preface this by, I want everybody who's listening to understand this. Between 1997 and 2007, Connecticut had the fastest growing economy probably in the nation on a per capita basis. National growth was about 24% over that period, but there was also population growth, so per capita was less than that. In Connecticut, we had almost no population growth, but we grew 33%. So we were going an awful lot faster. We were number one before 2008. Mm-hmm. After 2008, we become number 50. Mm. So something goes very wrong. And there, these things are never unicausal. It's lots of different things.
Sure.
You know, we'd let our infrastructure deteriorate. We had, you know, we hadn't done some of the things that, that we might have done, you know, at our universities. We weren't getting the same kind of commercialization, say, of intellectual property, though I'll say Yale has done a spectacular job. Mm-hmm. They've now got 50 companies that are spinoffs from Yale intellectual property, over $1 billion of investment.
Yeah.
UConn doesn't have a similar track record. It has not delivered on that front. And that's partly a product of internal policy. It's also a product of state policy and so on. But the big thing, I think, the single sort of single driver, remembering that this is only one of a number of, I mean, some of it's bad luck.
So it's
bad luck.
Somebody's got to be last.
Insurance industry that is, you know, being transformed by digital world.
Yep.
But the simple explanation, or the simplest explanation, is Connecticut somehow disconnected from the data-driven, digitally dependent modern economy. And how do we know that? We know that because when you look at occupations in Connecticut, it doesn't matter where people work,
mm-hmm.
but the nature of the occupation, if you look at the IT core occupations, which is the fastest growing occupational category nationally, and you look at Massachusetts and New York and Rhode Island, and they were all growing very strongly in this period. Connecticut had virtually no growth at all.
Hmm.
Rhode Island, my God, Rhode Island grew 10 times faster in IT-related occupations than Connecticut.
Hmm.
I have been told by an industry expert that there are high-speed fiber optic cables that go from Boston to New York without a single off-ramp in Connecticut.
Hmm.
So this is the vision. Think of I-95, I-84, and I-91 closing all of their interchanges in Connecticut and becoming through roads.
Yeah, pipelines between. Yep.
And no and that's basically what appears to have happened to Connecticut.
Okay.
And so we end up focusing on tourism, hospitality, logistics.
Service industry stuff, yeah.
Service industries, which are low skill and low pay.
Great.
And that's where our job growth has been.
We always engage to the point where we can take up the whole hour because there's just so many factors related to what we talk about, Fred. I do want to take a break and come back and talk about this other study that your organization has just put out earlier this week or late last week. Fred Carstensen's with us. He's director of the Connecticut Center for Economic Analysis and a professor at the UConn School of Business. We're going to be back to talk about cannabis and its possible future in really generating some green for the state of Connecticut right after this break. Stay with us. Do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find one. Or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. Hey, I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Connecticut is in the final stretch, and the United States Census Bureau is actively completing non-response follow-up operations across every city, town, and municipality in the state to ensure a complete and accurate count of everyone living here in the state and across the country. By law, the Census Bureau must provide the first results from the 2020 census by December 31st, and to provide complete and accurate results by that deadline, census staffers are doing everything they can to collect a response from every household in Connecticut by September 30th. U.S. Census workers are urging households to respond, maximizing staff and production hours and ensuring data quality along the way. And don't forget, the best way to avoid a visit from a census taker at home is to complete the 2020 census online at 2020census.gov. All right, pleased to be back with an old and dear friend, Fred Carstensen. He is the director of the Connecticut Center for Economic Analysis and a professor at UConn School of Business. CCEA has just released a study on cannabis legalization and its ties to creating strong job growth and revenue and GDP. All the things that we have found has put Connecticut sort of at or just at the end of the line, economically speaking, in comparison with all our other states, and particularly with our neighboring states of New York, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island, only one of which currently has a legal cannabis situation. And I guess Rhode Island, maybe if we were talking about who's next closest to make it happen, it is them. New York, it's still, I guess, a toss-up, Fred. Tell us a little bit about the CCEA study on cannabis legalization.
Well, we were asked by the Marijuana Policy Project several months ago to develop an analysis, a dynamic analysis that looks out over the first 5 years of retail sales. So it's 6 years in total because you have 1 year of startup for things, the state getting its regulatory framework in place for producers to develop the capacity to produce. And they asked us, would we look at what legalization would mean for the state of Connecticut in terms of job creation and in terms of state revenue and state GDP? And that's, we have a very, very special model of the state's economy that permits us to look at these kinds of effects over a long period of time. We've done, we did the analysis, for instance, for Vineyard Wind for the Yep. offshore 805 Yep. Kilowatt project. Mm-hmm. And we, for that, we actually did a 30-year okay. projection on what it would mean. So we have a lot of experience looking at these specific issues and figuring out what it's going to mean for the state.
Yeah, well, in the last four or five minutes that we have with you, Fred, what are the high points of the study, if we may?
Give me the bottom line, and we modeled this looking very closely what the experience of other states, but depending on how the state taxes this and depending on how it will spend the money that it comes in, we're looking at something between 10,000 net new permanent jobs and 17,000. It's a wide range because we don't know how the state's going to spend the money.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all very clear in the report. In aggregate, the state and municipalities, which get a 3% sales tax for locally, state in aggregate over the 6 years, it would add up to possibly $1 billion in new revenue for the state and mm-hmm. localities. And we believe that the study is actually quite conservative. We think the numbers could be substantially higher because the model that we're using actually is fairly optimistic about what would happen without this development. We think that it is more optimistic than it should be. We think a longer perspective, and we're actually going to come out with a 10-year forecast for the state's economy in a couple of weeks. We think that Connecticut, absent some very significant interventions, not just on this, but in other areas, is in for a very, very difficult period. And so this could figure in that 11 states have already made it recreational. More than 30 states have already approved medical marijuana, as has Connecticut. We already have medical marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
So this could really help us recover from the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic shutdowns, and it could also help us restore that competitiveness that we lost in the period after 2008.
I found it intriguing that Jason Ortiz from the Minority Cannabis Business Association weighed in on this very favorably. In terms of the role, where the naysayers indicate that this would just be more of a detriment to our minority communities, there's actually an idea that legalized cannabis could actually be an economic driver for these communities.
Well, it would give them real employment, and you know the fact of the matter is, cannabis is already here. We're already consuming it. You know, but we're consuming illegal, unregulated, potentially contaminated, with no oversight on its quality and its level of the drug.
Sure.
That it includes. And as Colorado has done, they have been very aggressive about policing the structure, making sure that it's non-contaminated, that the quality is what it is alleged to be. And they have dedicated part of that money that has come from the legalization of recreational marijuana to systematic medical studies. So we actually understand. We think it's not as bad as alcohol and tobacco.
Mm.
Tobacco, of course, is particularly, but alcohol in excess. I mean, alcohol is ironic because in small quantities, we often think it seems to actually have some benefits. We don't know enough about cannabis in terms of detailed long-term studies. And one of the things that legalization has done, besides getting a regulatory framework that permits us to address these issues and gets rid of a lot of the problems with, you know, an illegal substance, which is widely used, and it results in a lot of arrests and so on. And, of course, we've essentially backed away from that to a degree.
Yeah.
But it's a very confusing situation. Let's clarify the situation. Personally, and this isn't in the study, the purpose of the study was simply to report on job creation. But personally, I'm like, it's already here. We already have all the problems that people are complaining about. Legalization actually permits us to address them more coherently and more meaningfully, and it gives us the money to do so.
Yeah.
Right now, we're sort of in the worst possible. It's already being consumed. It's already widely available.
Yeah.
My understanding, I'm not a user, but my understanding, I know some people who are, and they tell me that it's very easy to get. I mean, it's here, folks.
Right.
So let's legalize it and bring it under the umbrella of oversight.
Right. So we're already over time.
Be honest about the issue.
Yeah, we're already over time, but there is one more important question I hope you can briefly just begin to address, and then hopefully we can circle back and talk more about this before the end of the year, Fred. And that is the negative, the red ink that we talked about in the first half of our conversation. Can that be either wiped out or substantially addressed by the potential $500 million to $1 billion a year that Connecticut may see in legalized cannabis revenue in the next 3 years?
It would only mitigate it. We need several other very significant initiatives on the part of the state. We are extremely competitive if we have the right regulatory and tax structure to actually build hyperscale cloud $1 billion data centers,
yep,
which would drive a tremendous amount of economic growth and, yep, what we call co-location.
Yes.
Companies would be attracted here. There are several other initiatives that the state ought to be considering very seriously. If this is an urgent matter, and the legislature and the governor should carve out a period of time when they focus just on economic development, because we've got to change the trajectory that we're on. And the only way we're going to change it is if we get a variety of new state initiatives. They don't necessarily involve spending money.
Right.
They involve creating an appropriate framework to make us more competitive.
Very good. We got to leave it at that, Fred. But as always, never enough time and always incredibly compelling stuff, even for early on a Sunday morning. I hope a lot of people kind of hear it half asleep and then decide they're going to come back and check out the podcast to really dig a little bit more deeply into it. If you want to read the full report from CCEA on cannabis legalization and its potential to create strong growth in jobs, revenue, and GDP, go to MPP.org/CCEA. Our guest is the director of CCEA here in Connecticut, Fred Carstensen, a professor at UConn School of Business and a longtime friend and resource to the award-winning For the People. Fred, thank you so much. So it was really just less than a month ago that a friend of mine received that's the chrysalis, the about to pop monarch butterfly, which then in the space of just a few hours emerged, ate most of that chrysalis, and then was gone. Mm-hmm. So it was the very first time in my life I had seen that in real time, and it was just so fascinating and brought me back to a love of this particular butterfly that I've had going back to childhood. So I couldn't be more thrilled when I received a note from Connecticut's Beardsley Zoo about its first collaboration with the citizen science program Monarch Watch. Beardsley Zoo trained volunteers to tag monarch butterflies to learn more about the migration of this threatened species. And a zoo educator, Jen Farrell, who's the lead educator on Monarch Watch, taught three of these online Zoom classes on monarch tagging. And in fact, she let the phone ring a few times when we just called her up because she was just tagging a couple more monarch butterflies. So this is a fantastic opportunity to kind of catch up on this childhood fascination of mine, but also to help remind people and educate them why these beautiful pollinators are so mission critical and so threatened right now, Jen. So thank you for joining us.
Yeah, John, thank you so much for having me. It is a pleasure to talk to you. It is a pleasure to, you know, promote this wonderful citizen science project. In fact, this is the first year that we are doing Monarch Watch at the zoo. And I think COVID was especially a unique time for everyone to start getting involved in citizen science. You know, people were at home. They were looking for, you know, other activities to get involved in. And there's really no better way to get involved in local conservation than by starting a citizen science project, you know, with the public. I mean, if you have a backyard, if you have a garden of your own, you see these butterflies, you see these monarchs, you know, starting to emerge around the summertime. And that's, you know, that's when they come up.
Yeah.
So the big part of the study is studying that migration patterns and the population that, you know, has been threatened. But, you know, we're trying to learn as much as we can about them in order to protect them.
Well, since the neonicotinoid situation started developing and killing off our bee populations now, almost a decade ago, maybe a little longer, we've been talking about the importance of pollinators, and certainly the monarch plays an important role in this. But
should we be paying more attention to the monarch butterfly due to its waning population and its role as a pollinator, or are there also other important environmental impacts tied to the reduced or waning population of monarch butterflies?
I would certainly say they are a good indicator species for all pollinators. So again, by studying monarchs and, you know, you if you see them a lot or even don't see them where you used to see them, you know, that's pretty significant. So we want to be, you know, be vigilant on not just the monarch butterfly, but all pollinators that are in our gardens as well. So they are all, you know, facing very similar threats. The monarch butterfly in particular, you know, seems to have a lot by way of, you know, we're, you know, as we expand in our agriculture and especially with genetically modified crops, sometimes that can affect the population. There was actually a recent study that was done for monarch butterflies. They were examining the milkweed along cornfields, you know, right in the middle of the country. And they noticed that because of the pollen that was going off of the corn into the milkweed that was surrounding the perimeter of those cornfields, that was affecting the caterpillars that were eating that milkweed. So there weren't as many monarchs, you know, in that area. So one of the things that this, you know, wonderful project can help track. So it's not just monarchs. It is, you know, again, it's, you know, bumblebees, honeybees, all pollinators, and they all serve that crucial, you know, purpose in our ecosystem by, you know, helping fertilize our plants and making sure that they're not just plants for us, but plants for all wildlife as well.
Well, Monarch Watch, as you mentioned, came out of the Heartland, the University of Kansas.
Correct.
Tell us a little bit about the classes that you taught and how that is paying off now as, you know, we start moving toward the colder weather and the migration of monarchs out of our scope here in Connecticut.
Absolutely. So Monarch Watch, just like you said, John, it is based out of the University of Kansas. Dr. Chip Taylor is actually the founder of the program. The program started in 1992, so it's almost 20 years old at this point. And he is one of the lead entomologists that has been studying the monarch population. Particularly what is so great about monarchs is everyone seems to know about the monarch butterflies. Everyone knows exactly what they look like, those bright orange wings with the black, you know, and white detailing. So they're very easily recognizable for a lot of people, even if you're not an entomologist or you don't know much about butterflies, but everyone knows the monarch. So year after year, especially starting in 1992 when he founded the project, you know, they were trying to record how many, you know, monarch butterflies were, you know, making their way up. And a big part of what this butterfly does is they exhibit two-way migration. And that is not terribly, I mean, some butterflies do it, but it is not extremely common in most. So very few butterflies. Most butterflies can migrate, but very few migrate the distance of a monarch because they cannot handle the colder weather when we get into the fall and the winter time. So they migrate down south and they overwinter in a very specific area in the Oyamel fir forests of south central Mexico. And these are fir forests that are about 10,000 feet above sea level, and they will, you know, attach to the trees. They kind of look like leaves themselves. If you've ever seen a monarch open and close its wings, you notice that it's dorsal side. So when its wings are open, the orange is much more vibrant than when they close their wings. It's a little more drab. It's a little lighter in color, and that's just to mimic, again, looking like a leaf for a monarch. So really good, you know, camouflage for them. And they will spend their time down there for the winter, and then they will return up in the spring. So as the weather and temperature starts warming up faster and faster, they start coming back up here to their breeding ground so they can lay eggs for the next generation.
So what role does the tagging of the monarchs play in the science and studies that have gotten you so excited?
So what the tagging does is, and this is particularly exciting because when we started doing this program, we've had a lot of people, you know, stop us and be like, wait, you can tag a butterfly, especially since, you know, they're very small, they're very delicate, you know, creatures, and we want to make sure there's a lot of success. And what Monarch Watch has done is they've created a tag that doesn't puncture the wing. It doesn't go through anything. It's a sticker, basically. And all butterflies are part of the order Lepidoptera. So that means scaly wings. So they have little teeny tiny scales that make up their beautiful, you know, colors and their beautiful wings for them to fly. And so what the tag does is it's actually a thicker adhesive. So it's not just your average sticker. It is very, very sticky. Mm-hmm. And it what it does is it adheres to those scales. So when they fly, it goes with them. And they're placed very specifically. So when a monarch closes its wings, it has a tined wings. And there's a special mitten-shaped cell right in the center of their back wing called the distal cell. And that is their center of gravity point. So the tag will go right in the middle of that cell, and that way it doesn't affect, you know, their balance when they fly away.
Yeah.
That's right, yeah. Exactly. And also it is only accounts for 2% of their body weight. A monarch butterfly, when they're in their adult stage, is roughly 500 milligrams. So it is only 2% of that body weight, so it does not, you know, hinder their flight at all.
So at this point, the butterflies have flown, so to speak. The program in terms of training is over, but it's always great to fire people up and give them something to look forward to. You had 24 plus people engaged in the tagging training this year. In the last couple minutes that we have with you, Jen, how can this program grow and be more important in 2021, hopefully when you'll be back in person and doing the training?
Yeah, absolutely. So we were definitely excited to launch it even during this year, like I said, because people can do this in their own backyard, socially distanced, you know, and still take a key role when we're finally safe enough to be back in person. That's where I hope in the next season, that's when I might want to plan, you know, group meetups and outings with our volunteers to go to different, you know, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, you know, wildflower fields and maybe do some tagging in various areas of the state. So, you know, not just it's something you can do individually if that is what your choice is, but you can also maybe meet up with us and really, you know, start a bit of a, you know, tagging group and just, you know, keeping this work going because it is a lot of fun. It's much more hands-on than people realize. And you're involved in live science. All of your tags, which they have an alphanumeric code, so each tag is unique. And has that unique code for your butterfly. And the University of Kansas, their research team will go down south for to Mexico to that overwintering site and try and retrieve as many tags as possible down there to see who made it.
Great.
And this really helps them study, you know, what first of all, what is the population doing? How are those numbers? Are they stable? Are they dipping? Are they rising? But it also helps them answer the questions like, you know, does a monarch from Connecticut, are they more successful than a monarch flying from Arizona? Because again, in Arizona, they're a bit closer. So what is the, you know, what are the factors in each area that determines their success rate?
Very good.
Also these butterflies, the ones that do make it down south, they live 8 months longer than their great grandparents, their parents, and their grandparents. They are what is called the final generation, or I like to call them the fourth generation. Because timing is a very important thing when you're tagging butterflies. It can't just be all throughout the summer. The butterflies that are here in the summer die out maybe between 2 to 5 weeks, and their responsibility is to lay the eggs. And it is always the fourth generation at the end of the summer that is supercharged. And we don't exactly know what it is about this fourth generation that is strong enough to make the 3,000-mile journey down south. So that is a big part of what they're studying as well.
Fantastic. Well, we want to remind people that if they want to learn more about the study, that it's as simple as going to monarchwatch.org, and also speaks to the reason why people should not only attend and patronize the Beardsley Zoo, but consider being a Zoo member, because then you're on the fast track to get advanced information on all of the kinds of things like the frog tagging and frog watch that the zoo has done so successfully, as well as this Monarch Watch and many other ways to engage yourselves. Monarch Watch encourages individuals to engage with nature, but provides critical information in the Monarch database that's used for further research. We heard all about it from Jen Farrell, who's the lead Monarch Watch educator at the Beardsley Zoo. BeardsleyZoo.org is the website to go to for all that local information. Jen, we thank you so much for being part of the program this morning and bringing us up to speed on what these beautiful monarch butterflies are doing and what they mean to our environment here in Connecticut and globally. So thanks for your time. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey, it's Austin James. Yes, I'm living with diabetes, but it doesn't have to define me. Thanks to the Freestyle Libre 3 Plus sensor, I get real-time glucose readings throughout the day. The Freestyle Libre 3 Plus sensor is small and easy to wear, giving me the freedom to focus on my life as a parent and a musician. Now this is progress. You can get a free sensor at freestylelibre.us.
Offer available for people who qualify. Visit myfreestyle.us to see all terms and conditions. Certain exclusions apply. Data on file, Abbott Diabetes Care, for prescription only. Safety info found at freestylelibre.us.